listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast, recorded at the BVA headquarters with your hosts, Bill Whitaker and Tommy Alquist. Bill is the former CEO of the J.R. Simplot Company and is now a full-time adventure seeker and philanthropist. Tommy is the CEO of BVA Development, co-founder of Crush the Curve Idaho, and most importantly, a full-time grandfather. Each episode focuses on sharing the stories of individuals who are changing the world.
Welcome to another episode of Inspire Excellence. Bill, we are really excited today. I'm going to let you do an introduction of this guy. He's a good friend of both of ours. But I'll tell you, the name of the podcast is Inspire Excellence. And I cannot think of anyone that has done more inspiring and lifting of our community than this guy that's on with us today. So give an introduction to our warm friend, Bill.
Well, I am really glad to introduce Roger Quarles to our listeners. Roger is the executive director of at the Albertson Foundation. He's been very instrumental, particularly in education, and I think his whole career. I'm actually a little bit anxious to hear some of his early career development issues that are opportunities that he's created for education. But you know what's really interesting is his commitment to a broad-based community value. And when it comes to the inspiration of being very committed to individuals and the individual development of human beings, I don't think anybody qualifies for Inspire Excellence any better than Roger Quarles.
Welcome, buddy.
Thank you. That's awfully nice, both of you. Yeah, you guys are special people. So thanks for having me on today.
So, Roger, let me give us a little bit of flavor about someplace along the way you said, I'm going to be committed to education. Tell us how that all developed and how you got through making kind of lifetime decision, education decisions on your own, and to where you are today with the Albertson Foundation.
Yeah, so probably requires me to back up a step. So I would say, you know, a choice to move to public education was a second career for me. I started as a young man right out of college in the pizza business.
I forgot about this. Yeah.
So I started making pizza as a young man, and then that was a very interesting career, very fruitful. It was good for me and my family. But I think you guys probably know owning and operating restaurants is a full-time job, to say the least. And I did that for 10 years. And just by chance, you know, I think a lot of life is opportunity and luck and walking through these doors of opportunity. I volunteer coached boys basketball at Wood River High School as an assistant coach. I always loved coaching kids. I grew up playing basketball and coaching basketball. And just by a matter of circumstances, I happened to meet the superintendent of the school district, who I thought the superintendent was like the building and maintenance guy. I genuinely thought he was a guy that took care of the facilities for the school district. I didn't know he was in charge of the whole thing. So that was how naive I was about school. And the short version is they had a job in the business department that they could not fill. And this gentleman asked me if I would ever consider teaching high school. And I really had never thought about that, truly. But the more I thought about it, I was like, yeah, this is something that I really would like to do. And I was gradually working my way out of the restaurant business, selling a variety of locations. And that all just happened to come at the right time. And so I started teaching a school to work class, which was in the business department, which basically was getting high school kids internship opportunities in the community, which I knew well. And I fell in love, but part of my requirement was having to go back and get a teaching certificate because I did not study in my college early days to become a teacher. So that's how I got started, all by chance, and fell in love with it literally on day one.
Hey, Raj, can you let me jump before we go on? So then you did work your way up to becoming a superintendent, right?
And... Well, yeah, I started as a classroom teacher at Wood River High School in Haley, Idaho, in 1995 or 96, somewhere around there. And I would have been 35 years old. So I had enough under my feet in the way of the business side of things to know how business worked in the restaurant business. So that was high school teacher, which I should tell you that, you know, having to go back to school and get a teaching certificate, it was hard. I mean, who goes back to college when they're 35 years old to get a teaching certificate? Well, I did it. So I drove from Haley to Twin Falls two nights a week, sometimes three nights a week, to take classes to get a teaching endorsement, and was successful at that, and then fell in love with learning again, I guess. Certainly not driving back and forth to Twin Falls. I didn't fall in love with that, but that was just what you had to do back then. And so I kept going to school for another 3 years and earned an administrative master's degree. So a master's in education administration. Upon completing that degree, became the principal of Kuna High School. So I'd never been a principal either. And, you know, school people are tough. They can read right through the baloney. And but I was lucky enough to get hired as a high school principal in Kuna. I did that for 4 years and then went to, and again, mind you, I'm still in school. So I was a high school principal, but in order to be a superintendent in Idaho, you had to have what you called an ed specialist degree, which is pre-doctorate level work. Kept going. I didn't have to drive anywhere because I had to drive to Boise because U of I was right here in downtown Boise. And then eventually became the superintendent in the Caldwell School District.
Yeah, and I think that's important because what I love about being around you is you've got this experience that is rooted in this genuine desire to help kids and help people and help education. And you've got that experience that just speaks volumes when you talk about education. And I love hearing the story. So for our listeners today, guy's the real deal that kind of, you know, business career. And I think the business acumen you developed in the pizza world, you know, bringing that over, because one of the things about you is you don't just see, it's not just about educating kids, but it's about innovating and making the kids want to learn and want to grow and learn real world skills. And I just love being around you because of that. And I think it's that background of how you went through that that really has brought that authentic drive into what you now bring to the foundation.
Well, you guys know me well enough. I don't really do anything halfway. So if I make up my mind I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. So I learned as a young man from my dad, you know, if you're going to do something, you might as well do it right. Whether that was changing the oil in the car or studying for a class, or I probably wasn't a great student, you know, the first time around, but I you know, had good parents and good upbringing. And so that was kind of the driver for doing things well. But I was going to share with you some of the gifts that you don't know at the time in my journey. Was Blaine County is the wealthiest school district in the state of Idaho out of 115 school districts. Kuna was the poorest school district in Idaho. And then Caldwell, where I wound up as the superintendent, was the largest, most demographically diverse school district in the state. So, you know, when you got an abundance of resources, it's a little less challenging on the financial front. And then when you work in a very poor school district, you got to make everything work. And then you go to a large school district that has, you know, a very demographically diverse student population, all of those things come into play with how you lead and how you make decisions. And so I learned a lot. I had the opportunity to learn a lot along the way. And hopefully I took advantage of those opportunities in a way that added value to what we were trying to do. And for me, my deeper moral purpose really developed early on in that it was my job as a professional educator to provide an outstanding education for every child, no matter who they were. Okay. That was for them and for their parents. And I took that moral purpose seriously. And I think ultimately it helped me. But I'd like to think we made an impact or a difference in kids' lives.
So, Roger, so I have a great deal of respect for the Albertson Foundation, the Joseph and Catherine Albertson Foundation. It has made, I think, a huge impact on communities, particularly across the state of Idaho. When did you join the Albertson Foundation, and why did you join the Albertson Foundation? What motivated you to shift gears?
Yeah. Well, you know, the average tenure of a superintendent in Idaho or in the country is somewhere between 2.5 to 3 years, which is kind of a shame because it's a hard job. I lasted 6 years in that role. And then what I didn't share with you is I did a 2-year stint at Boise State and helped them start their executive educational leadership program. And then I actually went to work as Idaho's chief deputy superintendent when Tom Luna was our state superintendent for about six
That's
months
right.
until he decided not to run again. So at that point in time, I was going to go back to Boise State, and I had become acquainted over the years with the J.A. and Catherine Albertson Foundation. I should have told you, so I kind of defined my career with three P's. So pizza, public education, and then philanthropy. So that third leg, Bill, to your question, I knew nothing about philanthropy. I knew that charitable organizations received grants. Typically, there was an application involved, had to be aligned with a mission or a vision. But in 2014, I met Joe Scott. And I had known Jamie for several years prior to that, Jamie Scott, who at the time was the executive director of the foundation. And Joe Scott, you know, we had a long conversation, and he basically said, had I ever thought about doing philanthropy for a living? And, you know, candidly, I said, no, I really know nothing, not that much about it. And so the trial was, well, let's try it. Let's do this. Let's try it for 90 days and see if you like it. And if we like you, and at the end of that 90 days, then maybe a position would open up for you here, and we could keep you on board. With this is what I really respect about Joe Scott, and that was he is hell-bent on being the employer of choice, and he likes to surround himself with people that have the same commitment to Idaho and the people that live here
right.
that he and his family does. And so instantly I fell in love with it, Bill, and have been on a pretty steep learning curve for going on 8 years now with the foundation. And I'd like to, again, go back and say I've been surrounded with very helpful people like you and Tommy and others in our board that makes the job purposeful, rewarding, interesting, challenging, and then ultimately trying to do good work, great work for the state and the people that live here, like I said earlier.
Well, you know, real quickly, I'm fortunate because I get to see some up close and personal Albertson Foundation activities, and I so appreciate getting to do that. At the same time, I know that it takes a lot of work to do philanthropy. I mean, this isn't about raising money; it's about investing money, spending money, and making sure that there's value. And that it's just not, we need to spend this for the IRS. This is very serious work, and Roger's an important part of it.
Hey, Rog, can I ask you a question? As I'm sitting here, I have my list of questions, but I'm thinking of some other ones. You know,
okay.
one of the things that's a little interesting and in our valley is, you know, I think Joe likes to keep a little bit of a low profile.
Yeah.
And I think his family does. And a lot of the work you do is pretty quiet. And I understand the need for that and, frankly, respect the heck out of it. the fact that it's kind of the quiet, deep, reflective work that, and I know the time and effort that goes into what, when you decide to invest in something, you've really put in the homework to make sure that those dollars are going where they need to go. But tell us a little bit from the inside, a little bit about Joe and his family, Brian and Jamie, and just a little bit about what their hearts are like and their love for this state and the people of our state, and just give you a chance to maybe talk about them a little bit, because I don't think a lot of people know about some of the work they do.
They are very private, Tommy, and you know them, and so do you, Bill. They are genuine people through and through. They care deeply about this state. They care about carrying out the legacy of Joe and Catherine Albertson Foundation, which was how the foundation got started back in 1966. So, you know, Joe and Catherine always thought that Albertson, that an education would be the pathway to prosperity. And so most of the early giving of the foundation was done around education work. And then Joe and Jamie, you know, Joe had very explicit instructions from his grandfather, which was Joe Albertson, and Catherine, his grandmother, that they wanted them to do, they wanted to utilize the foundation in a way that kept the next generation and the next generation involved. But going back specifically to Joe, Joe has genuinely tried to make a difference for kids and families throughout this state for his entire career. He's one of the most caring men I've ever met. Not only does he care deeply about his employees, he's a family man. He's very private, very quiet. He's really smart. He's a really smart cat. And, you know, we're not afraid to take risks, and that comes right from the top. Joe recently stepped aside as our board chair, and now Jamie has taken over that role, and she's actually our board chair and president. And it really is a family foundation. So what does that mean, Tommy and Bill? That means, you know, we talk about family engagement. So what gets that group excited? Leadership. We, you know, Bill talked about investing. I kind of look at it as a strategic way to deploy resources. So what they didn't tell me, you know, we typically give between $35 and $50 million a year to charitable groups throughout Idaho, mostly through initiatives that we create aligned with family values around leadership, learning, and strengthening community. And that's what you, how you'd really define donor intent. But when you think about Brian Scott and Jamie Scott and Joe Scott and their commitment, we operate under some pretty simple values. Our values internally and externally in all the work that we do are around leadership, which they all three exemplify. Innovation. Is it innovative? Is the work that we're doing really innovative? And is that driving new opportunities? Are we doing with it with integrity? Because I'll go back to the integrity level of the three individuals you asked me about. I would say it's top notch. They're always honest. They'll tell you, when you've got spinach in your teeth, they'll tell you when you're going down the right path and when you're not going down the right path, all with this commitment to continuous improvement. They're consummate learners. They're unbelievably well-read. I think the thing that strikes me the most is they're authentic and they're credible. And as human beings, I couldn't think of three more, you know, three other people besides you two, obviously, and some of my close friends that I want to spend most of my time with. And they're just special people. They're born Idahoans through and through, and they're relentless. They're relentless on keeping the great parts of Idaho together. But how are we constantly thinking about improving the quality of lives of the people that live here? And I can't, what kind of other purpose could you have professionally that's better than that?
So that's the best way to explain the Scott family, and the best way. And actually, you fit in that same mold, Roger. Let's shift a little bit, if we could, and talk about how important education has been to the Albertson Foundation. Some of the opportunities maybe that have been missed over decades, and maybe some of the current opportunities we have. But I'm really curious to go along with this is where does all this go in the future? What will Idaho education, what evolution will we get to experience? And maybe it's beyond charter schools. Where does it go? And maybe that's the question. Where does it go beyond charter schools?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to preface all of this with two things I say every single time. So I believe, Roger Quarles, that the education of our youth is the most important job on the planet. I can't think of a more important job.
Yeah.
Secondly, it's the most difficult job on the planet, in my mind. You know, I think it's harder than rocket science. I mean, that's math. Yeah. When you're dealing with 300,000 K through 12 kids in this state, and you're dealing with different cultural perspectives around the state, when you deal with, you know, kind of an oddball funding formula for funding kids and schools and teachers and buildings, it's fairly complicated, but the education of children is extremely complex. And so, most important job, most difficult job on the planet. And I don't know how much time, I know you guys have probably spent time in classrooms, but I've spent a lot of time in classrooms. And I'm a pretty practical person around the approach to educating kids. But fundamentally, as a leader in that space, I'm relentless on, we have kids from 8 to 4 every single day. It's what we do in that window that can change their lives for the better or make their lives harder. And so education, I say it's complex, but there are things that we could do differently that would make a dramatic difference for kids. So let me just tell you, I've spent a lot of time, obviously, in the field, almost 20 years in public education. And so when you look at it, foundationally, kids need solid academic skills from, you know, 4 or 5 years old to maybe 8, 9, 10. So math, reading, writing, you need those foundational building blocks that help kids succeed. Then when you get to about 5th, 6th, 7th grade, they need to begin to learn how to apply that learning. So early on, you're learning to read, then you're actually reading to learn. But we do things in such an antiquated approach that it begins, kids over time become less engaged in their learning the further they go through our system, to the point where 20% of them don't make it. They drop out before, compulsory attendance requirements run out. And so we have the incredible bones. So you got all these buildings. You've got these publicly elected school boards, by the way, which is that was my doctoral dissertation, was on highly effective school board members. But here are the requirements for being a school board member. You got to be 18 years old. You got to live in a certain boundary in a district and not have a felony on your record. And if you can do that, you can be a school board member. Just think about that for a second. And then you're up for an election every 2 to 3 years. And so it's constantly evolving. And our founders thought that that would be a good approach. So there's always new ideas and influx. But you can see when I said earlier in this call that if the life expectancy of a superintendent is typically 2.5 to 3 years, it's usually around you've made some hard choices and you've upset enough people in the community to where a couple people run for school board with one agenda item, and that's to get you out of the superintendent seat. So that whole relationship in 115 school districts alone in our state responsible, by the way, for spending $2 billion of state funding, which doesn't even include local property taxes for facilities, is a pretty heavy lift for a citizen in a community. So your heart might be in the right place, and then your responsibilities that go with that may be off a little bit, but it makes it hard to do anything with any continuity over time that makes things improve. So foundation, Bill, Tommy, we've got to get better at that. There's empirically proven valid and reliable ways to educate, you know, 5-year-olds to 8-9-year-olds, which simply requires adults behaving differently to produce a different result. But that's harder than you think. It's easier if you're data driven like I am, results driven, integrity driven. If you really put the needs of children first, that would change quickly. And then once you get that foundation established, then making 6th through 12th grade more relevant. And I really don't even think that's hard. But think about teachers. So this is not a knock against teachers, but they're professional educators. So their experience beyond the classroom is limited unless they've had other jobs throughout their lives. So how is what they're teaching applicable to real life? We've all been through this as children, and now we're adults. So where did the rubber meet the road for you guys? And I think that's where we could do a better job in middle and high school. And then I will tell you that I'm really disappointed in higher ed in regards to not owning their graduates, awarding degrees in areas that are frankly unemployable degrees. And I know that they don't see that as their responsibility, but where the rubber really meets the road is if you're fortunate enough to graduate high school and then go to college and then get a job, then hopefully the skill and training that you got along the way is applicable and relevant in that job. And so if you just take 5 seconds and think back about what I just shared, there are some things we can do in elementary, middle, secondary schools, and in post-secondary and college that would really change the trajectory for kids and young adults quickly, that would do all the things that we hope for. Drive better economic development, drive better, more responsible citizenry, make them better consumers of healthcare, make them more service-oriented in their communities and strengthen their communities. It's a longer game, and we're looking for quick fixes that don't typically happen fast enough, especially for people like us. And so I've narrowed it down to one thing. If we could find 115 amazing superintendents in this state, we could dramatically change the opportunities for kids overnight.
Yeah. Right.
Hey, Roger. Boy, I'm trying to unpack a little bit of what you said. I guess I just want to point out the wealth of knowledge that the foundation has pulled together, and the amount of expertise you have in a state like ours to say, hey, here are the things that would make things better. Pre-K, you know, elementary education, K-12, higher ed. I mean, it's just and I guess the frustration for guys like me, because every time I'm around you or I'm around the foundation, I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense. That makes so much sense. Why aren't we doing that? But what you just said, I think, is what I wanted to highlight, was it is the long game, right? And that's what I appreciate about what you're doing. It is, you're whittling away, and you're just trying, you care. Education is the most important thing for our kids, and you're in it for the long game. And I just wanted to say thank you for that, because even in the time I've known you, it is frustrating because things don't happen very quickly, but there are tremendous advancements being made, led by thoughts and innovation that are coming from your foundation. I remember, I won't get too personal here, but with my own kids, looking back at things that I've learned from you that we've implemented with our two youngest kids, there are things happening out there because of what you're doing. So thank you. I do want to pivot, because I know we could talk about education. Literally, we probably should have had you on like multiple times, because we could sit and talk about that. But Bill and I do want to get to Mission 43.
Absolutely.
Because I do think, just like a little bit, it's quietly one of the shining stars of our state, and what it does for people's lives to completely change the trajectory of their life. That's all been the brainchild and funding and the programmatic expertise of the foundation. Give us a little introduction, because I think a lot of people out there will be going, hey, I've seen the logo. I've heard about it, but what actually does it do? Can you kind of give us a little recap?
Yeah, I got to take one step back. So when I should have said this about Joe Scott, I didn't say he's a patriot. Joe Scott is an American patriot. He literally stuck his head in that door right over there 5 years ago and goes, can we do something for veterans in Idaho that's different than what the VA provides? That's how it all started. And so we went to work. We did some research, quite a bit of research. And Mission 43 was developed. So Idaho is the 43rd state in the country, and military folks like Mission. So it's called Mission 43. And we asked a lot of questions around what is it that our transitioning service members and our veterans and their families and their spouses need when they leave the military. First of all, most of them are trying to find a job. So who was the best at helping veterans find jobs? That was Hire Heroes USA. Veterans want to engage in their communities. So how does a transitioning veteran engage in their community? Well, we brought in Team Red, White, and Blue. They're pros at that. They get together for potlucks. They go on runs. They have family night in the park. They do all this really fun stuff. So that was it. What else do they need? Well, a lot of them want to use their GI Bill to further their education to be more employable. So a lot of these groups, I mean, these young guys are coming out 25, 26, 28 years old, 35. They are in their prime in starting down a career path. So we brought in Guild. We partnered with Guild, and that was to really align the educational need of the veterans and or their spouses to the opportunities they were pursuing. And then the last one is engagement. And so military service members, they feel like they're part of a tribe. And when their tribe is broken up and they go back to their local communities or wherever they choose to live, who's their tribe? What's their tribe going to be? So we started doing these Inc. events, Innovate, Network, and Connect, where we brought in speakers. That's evolved into this Leaders Fellowship, which you both are very familiar with. And that is, how do you identify the leaders in that community and help them along their path and their journey? So we landed on employment, education, engagement, and kind of service in that area. And then service back to the community and then engagement. And that's now evolved into a program that's pretty expansive and really to the point where we have 6,000 members in Idaho as part of Mission 43. We have successfully helped 1,000 Idaho veterans and or their spouses get jobs with an average starting salary of $59,000 a year. Our Inc. events now can be anywhere from, well, COVID's kind of thrown a wrench in this thing, but right pre-COVID, with the last one we had at the Warhawk Museum, thanks to Todd Lindsay, was 400 people. And so they're pining and they want to become part of this. But what we're seeing is that group now giving back more to our community than we ever expected. So sure, they're getting a benefit. They're getting a job. They're using their education. They're being engaged right in their community. But this service aspect of this thing is kind of mind-blowing. I mean, they want to give back. They want to be part of Idaho. They want to be part of Boise, wherever, Eastern Idaho, Northern Idaho, Coeur d'Alene. And it's just a remarkable group of I call them warriors. So the other thing that interesting about Mission 43 is a lot of veterans come back and it's almost like a stigma. And it's almost like a stumbling block for a lot of them. We are committed to changing that stigma from what it is now into a badge of honor, specifically in Idaho and what that means. So our slogan is Idaho as the destination for life after the military. And we want to recruit those post 9/11 veterans to move here, set up shop with their families, start their companies, go to work for your companies, and do amazing things. And we are I'm knocking on wood, but it's unbelievably successful. And it's led by Brian Madden, Dan Nelson, Allison Garrow, and a whole contingency of external partners. But it's remarkable and amazing. So we're very proud of Mission 43, and it's just kind of getting off the ground. That thing's going to be huge in years to come.
Yeah, Tommy and I have both been somewhat close to that, and education, employment, engagement. When it comes right down to it, when you see how it works and you get to be kind of ground floor with it, I got to attend an event at the Weurhoek Museum where Josh Sweeney spoke. Yeah. And I was absolutely blown away just listening, of course, to Josh speak, but also the interview that Dan had with him. And I'm going, my gosh, if there is a post 9/11 veteran that is in the state of Idaho, they should be part of this group.
Yeah. Well, we keep tracking them down one by one. These guys are amazing. They're making phone calls, sending emails, sending text messages saying, hey, come check this out, be part of this. And once you get them involved, Bill, I remember the look on your face when you were watching Josh Sweeney speak. For those of you who don't know, Josh Sweeney was blown up in Afghanistan. He's missing both legs right below his hips. And he's a Paralympic gold medalist in ice hockey.
Yeah.
Sled hockey.
Can you imagine? Right.
Yeah. And that dude, he scored the goal to beat the Russians 1-0 that put him into the gold medal game, and they won a gold medal. And he acts like, well, you know, it was just what I did.
And yeah.
He's an unbelievable athlete. And yeah. Just fascinating.
Well, he was motivating for me that evening, and actually other members of Mission 43 have been motivating for me, just the interactions that I've had with them.
Yeah, you know, Roger, the energy at the event, the energy from them, and then what I'll tell you is the follow-up emails, right? So, yeah. You know, you're lucky enough to go to an event and be part of it, and then it's not just one or two. They just keep coming. They stay engaged. It's so cool. I mean, it's just, it's so authentic and real and genuine in how it was started and how it's driven. And it's so Idaho-centric. I'm just really proud of, I got to tell you, the more I get to see what you're doing in the trenches, right? Because that's where it's happening. It's in the trenches. It's in schools, in the trenches, with everyday families. It's with veterans, Idaho veterans, in the trenches, changing their lives. It's so amazing, and it's happening relatively quietly, and I know that's how you like it. I know that's how you like it, but we're trying to talk about it today on the podcast because, one, it's really inspiring to see what's being done in Idaho, and two, there are others out there that may be listening or someone may know someone that may benefit from one of your programs. So we really appreciate you spending a little time getting us up to speed on those.
One thing that I don't really share with too many people, but I'm extremely proud of the way we do our work here at the foundation is, so we try to be as least prescriptive as possible, meaning we don't know everything. We have some of the knowledge, but we can gain knowledge and continue to learn as we move forward. So we didn't tell higher heroes how to do their jobs in Idaho. We just went and found the best and said, can you please come here and set up shop? I think some of the value in what we do is finding the right groups, the right individuals that have that same level of commitment that we do, and then really just stay out of their way. We focus on a vision or a dream or an ideal, and then we try to live into that, not up to that. And that it makes me so proud to do the work that way, because everybody comes to it with a different approach. And who's to say your way is the right way? You know, we'd rather be in the relationship than be right 10 times out of 10.
Yeah. But Roger, that's so unique in the world we live in, right? What you just said, you don't hear in other companies or in government, or that what you just said is so, it makes sense when you hear it, but of course that's the way it should be, right? And that's what sparks the innovation that you've been able to accomplish at the foundation, right? Because you do listen, you're out there, you're leading edge. I mean, I'll never forget over the years, as I've been involved in several boards that have applied for grants from the foundation. Everyone knows is this cutting edge? Is this something new? Is this something that's going to bring new thoughts or ideas to this problem? And if not, you're probably going down the wrong path. So the culture and that brand awareness that you've done, I just can't thank you enough for one, teaching the rest of us how to think that way, and two, setting an example, a real world example of how to do it. It's phenomenal.
You guys already think that way. You guys already think like that.
Well,
thank you, Tommy.
Listen, I watch projects come up around the community and even the state of Idaho, and watch the sincerity by which the Albertson Foundation approaches those projects. It's just like Tommy said, there is a reality. It's education is critical. Of course, Mission 43 is critical. There are other projects. There are other opportunities that I watch you guys take a really hard look and a very in-depth look. And I could list a lot of them that I know about, but I'll let you, if you want it, if you'd like to do it, fine. But it's not like you guys are waving a flag ever about, look what we've done. And
a lot of times we don't put our names on things.
No, I know it. I know
it. We'd rather have our partners put their name on it. I mean, usually if we get to that point, the money's the easy part. They've got the right leadership. They've got the right mission vision. They got the right team established. It's their deal. All we did was help accelerate it. So that's really the direction, the way we think about things is, can our funding accelerate opportunities in Idaho? And Bill, I know you know that and you've heard that so many times, but use money as a catalyst, not as a leverage.
Yeah.
Really use it in a way that drives the values that we subscribe to. I'll give you one of my easiest things that I share from time to time. You guys are probably familiar with Road Skate Park under the interstate in Boise, down there underneath the connector. That was a flat piece of ground that Glenn Rhodes created. He just thought it would be great for kids to have a safe place to go skateboard. Well, there was a few rails and a few ramps down there, but I remember the business community complaining about kids on the sidewalk on their skateboards and running old people off the curb with their skateboards. And literally, Jamie Scott came in and she goes, do you think we could build a nicer skate park down at Rhodes Skate Park? And so we reached out to the Boise Skateboard Association. They designed it. They put the plan together. They took all of the input, all of the young skateboarders and the old skateboarders. And every time I go by Rhodes Skate Park,
yeah,
that thing is jam-packed with kids and moms and old dudes, maybe like us, that might want to ride a skateboard. I have no idea why. It's that little deal. We've hosted the X Games qualifier now like three times. And the whole idea was just to give kids a safe place to recreate. But it did do one other thing. It shined a big, bright light on the homeless issues that were surrounding that area. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to Mayor Beter at the time. I said, hey, this is going to be an incredible project, but I think there's going to be repercussions of how we're handling or not addressing the homeless issues in Boise. And so that started a whole nother conversation that is frankly still going on about, what do you do? How do you help those that are less fortunate, you know? So it's those kind of projects that have implications, or I don't even call them consequences, opportunities around other things, but minimally, we did it for one reason: give kids a safe place to recreate,
yeah,
where it's all abilities, beginner to advanced, and that's what you got at Rhodes Skate Park.
Hey, our time's gone too fast, so I'm going to give Bill the last word. But maybe I can ask you one more question, then let Bill wrap up our episode here. Okay. Roger, one of the things, and I've been around a lot of people that are leaders in my life, and colleagues and friends that are in business world, but every single time I'm around you or the foundation, I walk away learning something. I mean, the structure, the way you do things, it's really pretty amazing. If you were to give one of our listeners some advice today, at the end of this, young professional, someone out there that's saying, hey, I want to make a difference in the world. I want to give back. I want to be a leader. I want to do something to really make a difference. What advice would you give them?
Well, that's a really good question, Tommy. I'll tell you what I tell my kids. which you know, I love my kids more than anything on the planet, and that is find a passion, learn everything you can about that, walk with humility, make yourself vulnerable, don't know everything, and really strive to be the best at something. And listen to those that have walked the path before you. So there are people like you guys that, Tommy, to your point, I learn something from you every single time we get together, and I'm always inspired. Same thing with you, Bill. Pay attention. Value the wisdom of people that have tried it. Be a risk taker. Don't be afraid to take risks. Don't be afraid to fail. You can't be a winner if you're afraid of failing. I mean, someone's got to lose. And you may lose a few times before you get to where you want to go. But be curious, not nosy. That's my big one. I learned that from Devin, who was in here with helping me with the computer. Be curious about stuff. And then, you know, there's a lot of material out there that research that says to be really good at something, you got to put in about 10,000 hours. So are you willing to put in the 10,000 hours to be really good at something? And if you are, by all means, do it.
Love it.
Boy, that is fantastic. Hey, in closing, at the risk of getting too kumbaya type on closing, you're an important guy to me and the Scott family. I really appreciated you talking about the Scott family because they're important to me personally, but they're also important to our community. I feel like your anchor position as executive director of the Albertson Foundation is huge. I think the Albertson Foundation it has been fantastic, and to have you on our Inspire Excellence podcast, where we get to literally comment on have discussions with people to help us bring forward those that inspire excellence. You're one of those people. And Roger, thanks for the time today.
Yeah, you guys are amazing. Keep it up. You're doing incredible work.
Thanks, okay. Roger. Appreciate you. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you next time on our next Inspire Excellence podcast. Go find something that inspires you and inspire someone else. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Inspire Excellence podcast. We hope you've heard something today that will inspire you to make a difference in the world. Join us again for our next episode.